but its dying move was to sink its fangs into Doc's wrist. It was a feeble bite, not painful as it broke the skin, but enough to deposit some of the viscid fluid into Doc's bloodstream.
Holy Mother of God!
Doc's arm burned, then numbed. Doc dropped the chilled cat, suddenly pulled back into the world of the Deathlands by the burning sensation sweeping through his body, followed by the numbness of sudden paralysis. Jack saw the dying cat bite Doc and saw the stricken man fall to the ground. He immediately knew what had happened and knew that he had to get to Doc and get him clear before the remains of the cat pack fell upon the prone man. By now, the Uzi and H&K fire was beginning to tell on the cat pack, and those that weren't injured or chilled were beginning to thin out and scatter, their courage and pack instinct now shot to pieces by the continuous blaster fire. But there were still enough to attack Doc where he lay, with enough venom in their fangs to chill him before they ripped him apart.
Cover me! Get Doc out!
As Jack raced forward, he holstered the Colt Python and palmed two of the leaf-bladed throwing knives. Stooping low as he ran, Jack flicked his wrists and the knives became whirring blurs that caught the flesh and fur of the cats that had clustered around Doc, closing in for the kill. But Jack was also closing in for the kill, and he was a far more experienced and ruthless hunter than anything the cats would have previously faced in the desert. As he moved in, the whirring blades made short work of the cats around Doc. Jack made sure that none of them got another bite in at the prone man, always angling his blade to drive them clear as much as chill them. Behind him, the rest of the wreck party kept the immediate area clear by firing at any of the felines that remained. The cats that weren't chilled by Jack's razor-sharp blades ran, their terror and pain deflecting their attention away from the food that Doc represented. The blaster fire echoed away in the desert air to silence as the last of the cats disappeared, melting into the desert as though they had never existed. The only signs that there had been a cat attack were the vast number of mutilated corpses and the prone Doc Tanner. Jack dropped to his knees beside him, pulling at the old man's arm and exposing the bite wound. It was swollen and red, with a buildup of venom in the lump that surrounded the two fang marks.
Sorry, Doc. Gotta do this.
My dear Mr. Lauren, no need to apologize. I feel the preservation of my own existence most definitely a matter of paramount importance.
Does he ever shut up?
Not even when dying, Danny.
Slipping one of the knives back into its hiding place, Jack kept hold of Doc's arm and transferred the remaining knife to his free hand, immediately slitting the red lump, which spilled out a pressurized mixture of blood and venom.
Oof. Sorry.
No.
Doc's throat had suddenly become paralyzed. He tried talking, but could only flap his mouth like a hooked fish.
Shit!
Jack quickly bent his head and furiously applied his lips to the open wound, sucking out the poison that remained in Doc's wrist, then spitting it out onto the dust. Dean was by Jack's side immediately with a canteen of water. Jack swished water around in his mouth and spat out the remainder of the blood and venom.
What do you think, Jack?
Doc live, but maybe have to carry a while. Take time, poison sweat out. Give him water.
Dean bent and forced some water into Doc, even though the old man's paralyzed throat found it hard to accept the liquid.
Fuck! I thought this was gonna be a rest stop.
Yeah, Mick, it is. Rest up for a while, then we should get going. We can't lose time now, especially if we need to carry Doc.
While they took a rest break, keeping away from the scene of the carnage, Dean and Jack constructed a makeshift stretcher from parts of the lightweight tents. Tilly and Danny agreed to take the first leg carrying Doc. The only good news during the rest period was that Doc already seemed to be regaining some use of his muscles, as his legs were already beginning to twitch involuntarily. Finally, they were ready to begin again. Tilly and Danny lifted the stretcher, and Lonnie took the lead. The sun overhead was past the halfway mark of the day, and they still had a lot of ground to cover. The plan was to be on the edge of Charity by nightfall, using the cover of darkness to bypass the irregular patrols of Baron Al, and to camp overnight before starting their wreck mission properly when the dawn broke, by which time they could only hope that Doc would be back to full mobility. When dawn broke, it caught them all by surprise. Jack was on watch and roused the rest of the wreck party, including Doc.
I feel a little stiff in the muscles, but otherwise ready to take on anything.
The deathly pallor of his skin told another story.
Well, Doc, you do know that we can't carry you when we're in there.
Lonnie gave a sidelong glance at Jack and Dean, just to let them know that he was sure they would be loyal to Doc, but his people couldn't afford to be if they found themselves up against it.
Yeah, we got you, Lonnie.
Okay, then. We need to scout the whole ville, see if there's any big sign of SEC activity, find the base where the convoy was set off from, and assess the amount of wags and armory being used.
You know where we're headed?
Know this place all too well, and I know a way in.
Charity was built around the remains of an old New Mexico town, the name of which had long since been forgotten. But it had been a one-horse town, and possibly a one-wag town, in the days when such things counted. It had been isolated and off the beaten track for any enemy attacks during the New Cost. As such, it had only been the nuclear winter that swept the Deathlands that had damaged the old buildings. And this was in places minimal, as the town had been built to withstand the harsh heat and desert winds, with low adobe buildings and very little over two stories. When the ancestors of the current Baron and the interbred families that made up the Ville's elite had first come to the old town, they had taken over the most repairable and least damaged buildings, which were those that were residential, and thus smaller than the more damaged shops and small businesses that were either directly on the main street or clustered on the edge. These larger and more damaged places had been taken over and used by the trickle of outsiders who had come to the Ville over the preceding years, to such an extent, in fact, that smaller buildings made of waste rubble and corrugated iron had been built into shacks that ran off the main drag and into the areas around the old business area. As well as housing the overspill of newer residents to Charity, these places also played host to a different kind of business. Before Skydark, the main drag of the town had been home to the grocery store, the tourist trap gift shops, the clothes and furniture stores of a normal ville. Now the trading for food and clothing was carried on in other quarters, and there were no tourists, only outsiders. The business that was carried on in these areas was the sale of jolt and derivative chemicals and hallucinogenic plant extracts. This was, after all, New Mexico, where such plants grew in abundance and were stronger than ever after rad mutation. There were also saloons where you could drink cheap liquor until you dropped, and gaudies where you could sate your carnal needs if you had the ability after spending so long in the saloon. There was no law anymore, so these businesses couldn't be outside any law. These were violent times, so the idea of a no-go area for Charity residents was ridiculous. On the contrary, they loved the main drag and the old business district. But there was a distinct purpose to making the main drag and the business district the areas where there were bars and gaudies and drug dens. By containing all these activities strictly to within these areas, Baron Al Jurgensen and the barons who had preceded him had been able to control the amount of jack that flowed in and out of Charity with a firmer hand than in many other villes. People knew where to buy and where to sell, and even at 7 in the morning, it was always party time down on the drag, and party time in Baron Al's private vault. But all the jack in the world wouldn't buy seed crops, wouldn't buy food, if there were none to be had. Hence the deal with Summerfield and the sale of the Ville's women, and hence the trade caravan that the Hellbenders were out to raid. Gaining access to the Ville had been absurdly easy. It was isolated and off the main roads and trails that ran through these parts. Only those who truly wished to visit the Ville, either for trade or for pleasure, would come this way. So the SEC guards who patrolled the perimeter were inclined to be slack at times, especially as the land was flat for miles around, and any wags would be easy to see from a distance. Not so a party of 7 who traveled light and had selected a sheltering place to hide out. Once they had packed their tents away and eaten from some of the self-heats that they had carried as supplies, they assembled around Lonnie, who told them that from his knowledge of the SEC routine, there would be a gap of less than an hour where they could just walk in. It seemed a long time to wait as the sun began to blaze hot. The SEC guards patrolled the Ville perimeter on old motorcycles, fuel being one of the few things Baron Al had a supply of, and one of the things that he had tried to use for trade.
There they go.
2 SEC guards on old choppers, with belts of ammo across their chests and old Thompson blasters resting in the crook of their arms, crossed virtually right in front of the spot where the wreck party was concealed. The guards stopped to talk briefly, the hum of their conversation buried beneath the guttural growl of their bikes. Then they throttled the choppers and moved off in opposite directions.
And that's it?
Yep, that's it. See, most people only come to this ville to trade with Baron Al or to visit the Drag, and they're pretty few and far between.
But isn't Al worried about you or Corell or anyone?
He thinks we all bought the farm when we left. In his world, no one survives without Baron Al, which is kind of useful for us when you think about it. Come on, let's go.